Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, do you know that there are thousands of Connecticut students falling behind because they don't consistently attend class? Well, this week we're going to kick off a trio of Encore for the People segments by replaying an interview from National Attendance Awareness Month when we talked with the Governor's Prevention Partnership about this issue and put a call out for mentors to help these at-risk students. Then we'll replay a call with the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities to talk in part about how that agency is assisting municipal leaders throughout the state in coming to grips with the opioid epidemic in their communities, thanks to a new and useful municipal toolkit. Then we'll close replaying a conversation with the president and CEO of Trinity Health New England, one of the growing networks of healthcare centers coming to the region as a result of mergers among formerly independent and community hospitals. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Food and Drug Administration wants you to know that many medicines used to treat colds and flu contain acetaminophen, a pain reliever and fever reducer found in hundreds of over-the-counter and prescription medicines. But taking too much or more than one medication containing acetaminophen per day can cause damage to your liver. So always read the label and don't take acetaminophen if you drink three or more alcoholic drinks every day. To learn more, visit fda.gov/OTC pain info. It's been a while since we talked to our friends from the Governor's Prevention Partnership, doing great work while many Connecticut students have already headed back to school. There's many more already in danger of falling behind just because they don't consistently attend class. During National Attendance Awareness Month here in September, the Governor's Prevention Partnership is seeking mentors to help at-risk students. And today we're being joined by a new friend from the GPP, Denise Marois. She's program coordinator with the Governor's Prevention Partnership. And we're going to be talking about this important initiative about keeping kids in school and making sure they're not tardy or skipping. So, Denise, thanks for being on the program. Great to meet you.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
So, for starters, let's talk a little bit about what the Governor's Prevention Partnership is all about.
Sure. So, the Governor's Prevention Partnership is a capacity building organization, right? So, we don't do direct service with children, but what we do is we help to build other organizations' capacities to do the work that they do. So, you know, whether that's through helping them find grant funding or, you know, helping them with technical assistance, you know, helping them find resources and, you know, things that they need to sort of be able to really expand their programs and to do it well. That's what we do. And the three pillars that we do that around are mentoring, bully prevention, and substance abuse prevention.
So when it comes to issues about absenteeism in school, that is something that's tied to the mentoring.
Very much so. So that's been a major focus, certainly since I've been here, which has only been a couple of months, but I know it's been, you know, a big initiative through the State Department of Education. It's been a big initiative through the federal organization, Attendance Awareness. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that is on people's radar. And, you know, Connecticut is definitely, I think, you know, most schools in Connecticut at this point have something in order to sort of, you know, take a look at the chronically absent children in their school and figure out some sort of way to start combating that. So it's, you know, trying for us, and I think for SDE and, you know, it's trying to figure out ways that we can best support these programs and a lot of ways that we are starting to find out that we can do that is through mentoring. And a lot of times that's not, even necessarily very intensive mentoring. It can be just through morning check-ins and, you know, somebody that's sort of there when the kid gets off the bus or comes through the front door saying, hey, I'm glad to see you today, or, you know, I really missed you yesterday. You know, is there anything we can help you with? You know, why were you absent yesterday? And kind of let's talk about it. You know, and just sort of somebody that's kind of there for them so that they know that they've got a caring adult at the school that misses them when they're not there.
Yeah, and we talk so much on this program about the resources that can be made available to help kids succeed in school, from academic support and peer-to-peer kind of a tutoring and making sure they get healthy, hearty breakfasts and lunches, and even over the summertime in some cases when they're not in school. And we talk about trying to protect them both in the school environment and at home, providing them with low cost or no cost internet services. There's just so many things that we've done and talked about on this program to make sure that kids are positioned, no matter what their socioeconomic status, to succeed in school, because it's so critically important. But for this initiative, it's about getting them and keeping them in school. And I guess there's some pretty disturbing or intriguing statistics out there in regards to the relationship between attendance and academics. Why don't you run a few of those down for us?
Sure. So some of the statistics that there's been a lot of research done over the past probably 2 years. A lot of it has come through Attendance Works, which is the national organization. Hedy Chang is a fantastic person that oversees a lot of that. So things like missing 10% of school, which is 18 days, you know, you think of chronic absenteeism as a kid that's absent for a week at a time, but it really can be a day here, a day there that adds up to 18 days. And once you've hit that 10% mark, you're chronically absent. That's, you know, can be 2 days a month. They include excused and unexcused absences and suspensions. So, you know, just because you write a note to the school saying, hey, we're going on vacation, that's still time that your child is not being educated. So it still completely counts towards, you know, this chronic absence. It starts early. A lot of times, you know, it's kindergarten kids that we're seeing, or first grade students, because I think at that time, you know, parents don't really necessarily always understand that there's a lot of really heavy learning that's going on there. But what we've found is that if kids are not proficient with their reading by third grade, that can really have major effects on them going forward. So, you know, we really kind of need those kids in school, engaged in their seats and being educated, and not being pulled out for different things, because it really can have an effect on them going forward, you know, all the way to high school dropout rates or, you know, not moving on to college and things like that. So by sixth grade, chronic absenteeism can indicate to us that a student is much more likely to drop out of high school. So, you know, we can really start noticing these things at very early ages, and that's where we're trying to catch a lot of these kids.
Yeah, and talking to folks like yourself and educators, there's a few things that are kind of going on in the dynamic, including I guess there's some cultural predispositions for certain ethnic groups to, you know, not be as engaged in the early stage of education, or not seeing that cost value relationship between making sure that their child is in school all the time when they're like kindergarten, first grade. For whatever reason, there's a lot more stock put on the upper grades, and when they sort of think the rubber really hits the road, but that is not the case anymore. Even pre-K is becoming a really critical thing here in Connecticut. But the other dynamic is, you know, if it's a single parent household, if it's a parent who works multiple jobs and there's older siblings, there's a lot of situations where the older sibling is sort of in charge of the younger one's comings and goings. If the parent is sick, maybe that child won't be able to go to school that day. There are a lot of socioeconomic factors and cultural factors that sort of weigh in and make this a much more challenging issue.
There certainly are. So absolutely there is a definite skew towards folks that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. Mm. So we're finding a lot of chronic absenteeism in our urban areas, and just like you said, a lot of that oftentimes has to do with factors at home. Is the child not getting to bed on time? Do they have are they being taken care of by an older child? Do they, single parent mom having a really tough time because she's got to get out the door and, the kid is kind of dragging their feet and, she just can't get the kid to school because she's got to get herself to work. We've found that, there's really high rates in, kids that have asthma. For whatever reason, asthma seems to be a leading indicator of chronic absenteeism. One of the other things that we've found is that kids that have physical and mental disabilities are tend to be out ahead in high rates of chronic absenteeism as well. Mm. A lot of it is trying to figure out kind of what are these barriers. And that really takes connection. It takes connection through the school, through social workers, through teachers. I think it takes a certain amount of trust on the part of kids and parents to feel like they can, kind of open up to folks and say, listen, we're really struggling here, but, we understand the consequence and we understand how important this is. I think in most cases a school can direct folks towards resources. They may have resources themselves that can help kind of combat these things and break down some of the barriers that they're facing. But it's a matter of making that connection and making sure that the parent really feels supported and not that this is a punitive thing and that kind of we're coming for you if you don't get your kid to school. But, hey, let's partner together and kind of figure out, what's going on and what can we do to help you.
Yeah.
And help your child.
And I guess it's a lot easier to identify a chronic truant or absent student when they do take these blocks of time off multiple days. It's the ones that just miss a day here or a day there that adds up. But it adds up to a pretty concerning benchmark, this 10% or 56,000 of Connecticut students being chronically absent. And so therefore, as the Governor's Prevention Partnership does so well, they initiate and partner and support. So hit us with a number of the initiatives that GBP is now engaging to tackle this 56,000 number and bring it down.
So we've got two major initiatives that are rolling out this year. The first one is a federal initiative, and that's called it's the My Brother's Keeper Success Mentors National Model. So we're in the second cohort of schools that are doing this. They did it last year and have had great success with it. Hartford was brought into the fold just this year, and it's not a grant associated. There's no funding associated with this, but it's a national model where they bring in schools and they do it, I believe, with either sixth graders or ninth graders. We're going to be doing it with ninth graders. Those are sort of the two places that we like to that. Indicators are heavy with those two grade levels, so we like to get the kids on in those two levels. So we're going to be rolling this out at three different high schools in Hartford. And basically what that looks like is there's a mentoring element to it where they can bring in outside folks. It can be, community partners, different nonprofits. It can be, businesses in the area. They utilize school staff, which can be anybody in the school. It can be the lunch lady. It can be a janitor. It can be a teacher, a counselor. And there's also a peer-to-peer model so that they can take some of the older students, juniors and seniors, and train them to be mentors just have them checking in with the kids every day. So it's basically an every morning check-in. We want to know that you're here. We want to greet you off the bus or greet you as you're walking in. If the child isn't there, then there's a phone call home. That phone call home is a positive phone call. It's a supportive phone call. It's a message to the parent or to the child saying, hey, we miss you. We want you here. it's buy-in from the rest of staff, right? So if a child is absent for a couple of days, we want to make sure that the teacher is supportive and that, you know, they welcome the child back into the classroom and say, hey, you know, glad you're here. Let's get you up to speed. You know, we really, you know, want to have you here and get you engaged. So what can we do to sort of get you caught up from the last couple of days? So it's a really fantastic model that they use. It's worked really well in a lot of the bigger cities and throughout the country, and we were lucky enough to get this offer to carry this program forward.
Super.
So the other program that we've got is EdCorps CT. So this is an AmeriCorps program. It's based on the city year model, which was implemented in Boston, and they've had great success with city year. And what that basically does is this was a grant that we received from AmeriCorps, and we will be recruiting 10 young AmeriCorps members. It's 18 to 24-year-olds, and we'll be putting them in full service, full-time, essentially as classroom assistants and full-time mentors in Simpson-Waverly School in the north end of Hartford, which has been hit very hard by absenteeism. Hmm. And this is an elementary school. So this is a really fantastic program where it's sort of a twofold benefit, right? So we get to help between 80 and 100 kids that are going to be paired up with these 10 mentors. But what we also get to do is take 18 to 24-year-olds in the city of Hartford and give them this fantastic, really intensive AmeriCorps training for a full school year. Mm. And they get an excellent experience out of that, a lot of team building, countless skills that they're going to be able to learn through this experience. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you know, they're alleviating a lot of that pressure off of Simpson-Waverly School, where, you know, they may not have the resources to be able to you know, really implement a really strong absenteeism program in their school. So, you know, they can meet regularly with teachers, meet regularly with counselors, be that sort of in-between person to the parent, and really just offer a lot of support. And they're there the entire year. So the wonderful thing is they get to really develop great relationships with these kids and, you know, hopefully really have a great impact there in a school that is very deserving and very needful of it. So
great. Well, time is growing short. We've only got a minute or two left with you, Denise, but we want to make sure people know that they can go to preventionworksct.org or attendanceworks.org. For more information on what can be done, including some tips that parents can do to help their child succeed. If we can keep it to about a minute, can you just run down the bullet points real quick, and so we can remind parents about how they can play an important role?
Sure. So, you know, things that we would like to say is, plan ahead, do as much as you can the night before to get your kid ready for the next day, packed lunches, laid out school clothes, things like that. The most important thing, I think, is make a connection to your school. Go to your child's school and introduce yourself and get to know their teacher and their counselors and things like that, so that if there is, you know, an issue, that you have a person there at the school that you feel comfortable with. Again, this is really about human beings making connections with one another, so that we can really give these kids the opportunity to succeed. So if you as a parent can go into the school and really feel supported there, you know, even if there's just one person there that you really feel very comfortable talking to, make that connection, seek that person out, and go and figure out what you can do to help your child succeed. And, you know, I think you'll find that your school is more than willing and very happy to help you in that, so that we can start figuring out some of these issues and breaking them down.
Fantastic. The Governor's Prevention Partnership has a focus on keeping Connecticut kids safe, successful, and drug-free for a stronger workforce tomorrow. This organization that started in 1989 as public-private nonprofit cooperation. And as you hear, chronic absenteeism right now, Connecticut, 10% of our students are chronically absent, tens of thousands of them, and the Governor's Prevention Partnership is working to reduce that number through these programs. You can learn more at preventionworksct.org or attendanceworks.org. Denise Marois is a representative of the Governor's Prevention Partnership. So pleased to have you on the program this morning, Denise. Thanks for all the great information. Well, today we're going to be talking about municipal sustainability and an issue that is facing all of Connecticut's 169 municipalities, as it is with municipalities all around the country, and in fact, as we're hearing, a global issue. We're talking about the opioid epidemic, and it's interesting that we're going to be tapping an organization that's typically dealing with municipal governments here in Connecticut on a number of other issues. If you don't know who the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities is, they're the state's largest nonpartisan organization of municipal leaders representing towns and cities of all sizes from all corners of Connecticut. 162 member municipalities seek the guidance and support of CCM. And I'm pleased to meet for the first time Ron Thomas. He's deputy director of CCM, and he's with us to talk a little bit about what's been happening lately. And it is a busy time, isn't it, Ron?
Oh, very, very busy. No longer do we have those times when there's an easy summer.
Lazy, hazy days of summer are now
exactly
taken up with serious business. And
exactly.
But before we jump into that, let's broaden the focus to 5,000 feet, if we could, and beyond the brief introduction. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit more of about what CCM does and why people who aren't engaged in the day-to-day business of Connecticut's municipal governments should, you know about the organization and how it helps them.
Sure. CCM is the statewide association of towns and cities in Connecticut. We represent the interest of municipal officials and property taxpayers in particular at the state capitol, lobbying on behalf of cities and towns. We're the primary organization that lobbies for things like property tax relief measures, education aid, youth service programs, you name it. We're involved in it at the Capitol. We also conduct professional development workshops for municipal officials. We have an annual meeting that's going to be coming up. We have forums, things along those lines that depend on some of the hot issues. We're going to be having a public safety summit at the end of September. Mm-hmm. And we also do things like represent the interests of towns and cities in the courts. So we provide a variety of services to municipalities. And if you look on our website at ccm-ct.org, you'll see a lot of our publications and things like that that we think would be of interest to the residents of Connecticut.
Excellent. So, as you may know, our program has been very responsive. You know, 28 years on the air here doing this program, and we've been talking about the challenges of addiction from day one, and it really has, you know, when we say epidemic proportions, that is not sensationalizing the issue of the current situation that we're in with opioids and heroin concerns in Connecticut. And as you indicate on your website, it really is a statewide emergency, and we've engaged recovery specialists and medical specialists and sociological and scientific specialists, and it's very interesting to bring CCM to the table on this conversation, because when people think of heroin and opioid addiction and its fallout, you don't really think of the cost to Connecticut taxpayers in what they're paying to the municipalities, but certainly public health agencies and the need to transport these individuals for medical care, police and EMS responses, all tax municipal governments and the taxpayers who support them.
Absolutely. I mean, as you said, Connecticut, like the rest of the country, is going through a serious opioid epidemic. And CCM, through the first selectman of Ridgefield, Rudy Marconi, developed a task force 2 years ago to look into the issue. We wanted to be thoughtful about it in terms of thinking about what towns and cities could do about this, because, as you said, the towns and cities have the police departments, there are these health districts, things along those lines, and really just our concern about you know, people not realizing their potential in homes being destroyed, that sort of thing. So we met we've been meeting regularly for 2 years. We've invited state speakers to come in, state agency heads, nonprofit organizations, and we've been having conversations, and we came up with a series of proposals. We're very happy to know that many of those proposals have been considered by the legislature, and some of them have been adopted. Again, it's one of those things where there's been a good state-local partnership in terms of trying to combat this very, very, very serious issue. One of the things that we found is that that there's a great deal of interest in trying to do something, but a lot of municipal officials just don't know what to do, where to begin, and that's why we developed the toolkit that we developed to help municipal officials start the conversation, to really think in terms of what can they do strategically to deal with this great epidemic.
Yeah, and you make a critically important point about Rudy Marconi and his pioneering initiative to address this problem. He saw it coming probably 6 months before it became, you know, the headlines and the lead stories on every newspaper, every website, every newscast, every magazine. And it remains there daily, perhaps even hourly, depending on the outlet that you're consulting. So he really put the task force, the work group, I should say, in a great position, because a lot of communities, I imagine, and even organizations like CCM around the country and the region are trying to struggle and catch up and to get to a place that Connecticut is already at, thanks to this work group and the, as you said, how local officials can combat drug abuse toolkit. Can you review a few of the key points of the toolkit and how they might be best, you know, assimilated and utilized in a community in a fast track way?
Sure. One of the things we wanted to do is try to have something that to offer suggestions that are manageable, to begin to have these types of important conversations on the local level. And one of the things that we suggest is for mayors, first electmen, municipal people, and people in the community to just take time to understand substance abuse and the drug epidemic in the community. Just start having community conversations, forums about the epidemic, and you'd be very surprised in terms of the kinds of information that you get and what comes up. In terms of municipalities, we're urging them to designate a municipal point person or contact person regarding substance abuse, so that there's one person in town hall who is that person that anybody can go to get information, can be that clearinghouse for information, that sort of thing. And then that municipal CEO should do like Rudy has done, and so many of our municipal CEOs, and take the lead to increase public awareness, and engagement, to kind of bring it outside and have a real discussion about it. And I think that helps a lot of the families that are going through it, because it's not something that they feel that they have to keep within their household and all the burdens associated with that. We're also encouraging towns to work together to think along the lines of regional cooperation, collaboration, that sort of thing. And to think about just developing a one-page fact sheet or resource guide for residents, either sending that out to residents via email or, you know, sending it via snail mail, just having this one-pager that can be made available to people and groups within the community, and also partner with schools on prevention programs and inserting into the curriculum this this discussion about substance abuse and ways to combat it and how problematic it really is, so that we can get our young people thinking about not getting involved in it, so that we don't have to deal with addiction, kind of really focusing on the prevention aspect of it. So those are just some of the changes.
Yeah, I have to say, Ron, for so long, the issue of addiction, especially when it involves heroin or opioid-based pharmaceuticals, has always been sort of a bottom-up struggle. There were individuals who had tragedies in their family, lost children, lost loved ones, tragic accidents involving individuals under the influence. And these were voices out in the dark kind of shouting exactly. to get their stories heard. And once in a while, you'd get a education professional or a law enforcement professional to kind of join the chorus. But now that it seems that CCM and Connecticut municipalities across the board are taking a top-down approach, the other thing that it's fast-tracking is the shedding of the stigma. It seems really like, you know, sadly, you know, like with cancer, it's like people weren't ashamed to say that they had cancer, but they were ashamed to say that they had, you know, some sort of addiction issue in their family, in their community, in their neighborhood, in their workplace. And it seems, thanks to the work that is being done, as I said, through CCM and the community level, that stigma and the loss of it is really helping folks to engage over these community forums and other activities that you're promoting.
Well, it's key, because if you're too embarrassed or ashamed, you're not going to seek out the services that are really needed. And having the mayor or first selectman, members of the board of selectmen or town council talk about it helps take the shame away from it and helps people understand that this is not something that you need to keep within your household, and that there are services out there that can be utilized, and that you should take advantage of them. One of the interesting things I saw during this fall and spring campaign for the presidency is how many people who were running for president talked about addiction in their families and the consequences for their families. And I said, this is really interesting, because it's showing that people are being more willing to talk about it, and that's going to be extremely helpful to people in cities and towns, not only in Connecticut, but throughout the country. So we definitely have to work at taking the stigma away from it and focusing on treatment and, of course, prevention.
Excellent. Folks, if you're joining us, Ron Thomas is on the line. He's Deputy Director of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, working to improve everyday life for every resident in Connecticut by sharing best practices and objective research to help local leaders govern more wisely. They also advocate at the state level for issues affecting taxpayers, as well as pooling buying power to negotiate more cost-effective services for all our communities here in Connecticut. We've got another important point to talk to Ron about in regards to community sustainability on another front that CCM has been working for all of us here in Connecticut. We've got about 7 or 8 more minutes to talk about that. We'll be back with Ron Thomas from the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities in just a moment. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The AARP Foundation is looking to expand its team of volunteers for the upcoming tax season by recruiting interested individuals. TaxAid is an AARP Foundation program that offers free tax filing help for those who need it most, especially adults 50 and older during tax season. Volunteer tax preparers complete tax preparation training and IRS certification prior to working with taxpayers. There's also a need for grassroots leadership, on-site greeters, those who can provide technical assistance, and interpreters for those who need language assistance. The program is offered at approximately 95 sites across Connecticut, including senior centers, libraries, and other convenient locations. If you'd like to learn more, go to aarpfoundation.org/taxaid. All right. Thanks for coming back. The Connecticut Conference of Municipalities is the state's largest nonpartisan organization of municipal leaders. It represents 162 of the 169 municipalities here in Connecticut. Almost got them all, but certainly their work benefits each and every one of us, no matter where we live. Ron Thomas is their deputy director. He is with us now, and we had been talking in the earlier segment about their work. In regards to the opioid crisis that is gripping here in Connecticut and around the nation. One of the other critical things that CCM has been working on, and really it's kind of a pillar of their initiative, although the watchword wasn't always so popular, is sustainable. And they are working on sustainable communities on Wednesday, August 3rd. In conjunction with the Institute for Sustainable Energy at Eastern Connecticut State University, the CCM has released a new public policy toolkit on sustainability. So we'll go from a toolkit to help municipalities in the grips of the opioid epidemic to turning their attention to the future and hopefully better times for all. Ron, tell us a little bit about the partnership that you guys forged with Eastern Connecticut State University and why they were the go-to academic partner to develop this public policy toolkit on sustainability.
Sure. CCM has had a task force on sustainability for a couple of years, and the idea behind the task force is to orient towns to the importance of creating sustainable communities, providing them with information, best practice models to help them with the work that they want to do on the local level. We were aware that Eastern Connecticut State University has a sustainability center, and we thought that it would be a good state-local mix by getting with them to help us develop this toolkit. And one of the things we thought about was that let's try to find out from some towns what's going on and what they're doing and some of the innovative things that towns are doing, and then share that with other communities, as well as share some things that cities and towns in other parts of the country are doing, and share that with our with the Connecticut municipal officials and Connecticut residents, period, and see where that goes in terms of getting people started on with regard to really thinking seriously about sustainability. So that's where the toolkit came about. The toolkit lists a variety of towns and cities in Connecticut, all the way from Bridgeport to some of our smaller communities like Seymour. So it gives you a wide variety of towns and cities. It gives you a wide variety of initiatives. Some of them focus on things like land use. Some of them focus on things like local foods, energy efficiency, clean energy generation. So it's a variety of initiatives that that a lot of towns and cities in Connecticut are involved in. And I think the breadth of projects will come as a surprise to a lot of people.
It's what's funny, Ron, is I can't remember where I saw it, but I was watching something somewhere in the past few days, and it was kind of a comic or a kind of lighthearted take on you know, having to deliver bad information to people, or maybe something that would make them uncomfortable. And one of the lines in the routine was, "Well, just stick the word sustainable in there, and it'll make everybody feel better." You know, as long as you use the word sustainable. And truth be told, sustainability by 100 other names has been a focus of both CCM and many Connecticut communities, you know, going back, you know, certainly to when CCM was formed and right. look at the local level, you know, for centuries, perhaps. One of the interesting points I found about this toolkit on sustainability is you actually broaden the focus outside of Connecticut and look at municipal initiatives that have worked elsewhere that might easily or effectively be assimilated here in the Nutmeg State. Do you recall or could you remind us of any of those initiatives that looked attractive to you and the team at Eastern Connecticut when you were developing this toolkit?
Yeah, well, again, I think Connecticut is the center of innovation, and we do great things here. I think that's known by just about everybody. However, I do think that we can learn from other communities that have thought about this more deeply and perhaps longer, and that's how true innovation happens, when you can build on the work of other communities. And that's why we decided to look into municipal initiatives outside of Connecticut, looking into places like Kansas City, Missouri, Portland, Oregon, and even some of the smaller communities like Pinecrest, Florida, and Dubuque, Iowa, in terms of strategies that those communities have taken. And one of the key things that we found is that the community has to do, much like with the substance abuse issue, is to just start having a discussion about why the community should be involved in sustainability efforts, why preserving the community for future generations is important and essential, and could be a vehicle through which to create jobs, too. I think that was a major focus of Bridgeport when it created its Bridgeport 2020 initiative. It was focused not only in terms of the sustainability, but creating quote-unquote green jobs for people in the community. So while I do think that Connecticut is a source of innovation, we have to also look and see what other states are doing, and that's what we did in this toolkit.
Yeah, in that sense, imitation is not only the most sincere form of flattery, but also a great way to make good ideas work at home. And that's just one of the focuses of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities Sustainable Communities Report, developed in cooperation with Eastern Connecticut State University. One of the two subjects that we are covering today on the program with Ron Thomas of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. He's that organization's deputy director, and sadly, although the conversation is lively, our time is over. And Ron, it was a real pleasure to meet you. I'm glad we had a chance to talk to the extent that we were. Folks, if you're just joining us, be reminded that the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities is the state's largest nonpartisan organization of municipal leaders. They pool buying power to negotiate more cost-effective services for communities, advocate at the state level for issues affecting you, local taxpayers, and share best practices and objective research to help local leaders like the two toolkits that we talked about today. You can learn more about them online at ccm-ct.org. Ron, a great conversation. Thanks for joining us. Well, as you may have heard, if you're a regular listener, we are looking into a number of various health system mergers and health system growth in Connecticut, and we're pleased to make the acquaintance and welcome Chris Dadles to the fold here. Chris has led St. Francis Care in transforming that organization into a real competitive and integrated health system with his strategic vision. He's creating great partnerships and focusing on building physician alignment. We've been blessed with a number of those physicians being on our program over the past year or two, as we've been leaning on St. Francis and their offices for resources for all our listeners throughout Connecticut. And now we have some exciting new developments. On October of 1st of 2015, St. Francis Care joined the Sisters of Providence Health Systems and formed a regional health delivery system under Trinity Health, now named Trinity Health New England. And Chris was named president and CEO of this new regional delivery health system, one of the largest in the Trinity organization. So, Chris, proud and pleased to meet you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to speak with you and your listeners.
So let's start from like the satellite view. You've been in this business a long time. Explain to our listeners a little bit about this phenomena that Connecticut is now getting a little bit more used to, but has really been a commonplace sort of in the West since probably the late 70s or early 80s, and has slowly sort of moved east and into some of the smaller states like Connecticut.
Well, this whole aspect of consolidation in the healthcare industry is happening, you know, nationwide now. And I think the impetus has been the Accountable Care Act. And when that came into fruition, everybody was focusing on what does that mean for us now, because the federal government and others are pushing us towards changing our payment system, because healthcare is extremely expensive and fragmented. So their focus was on how can we move to value instead of volume, and how can we become more efficient and remain high quality. So some years ago, I guess it was probably more than 7 years ago now, when that all came to be, we took our board of directors and created a new strategic plan and said we're going to jump both feet into this whole arena of population health and accountable care and restructure our organization to accommodate that. And so we looked at our model of care and we said we need to change and align with our doctors, create service line organization rather than a bureaucratic hospital situation. And we were successful at that. We were driving value by becoming one of the most efficient organizations in the state. And also, we drove the quality so that we could be one of the highest, if not the highest quality organization in the state. And putting those two together creates the value proposition. And we were very successful at that. However, we were trying to decide in the new world how much scale you needed to be successful and what does an organization need to look like, because you need a geographic presence, a broad geographic presence to take care of a large population around accountable care and population health. And we felt that we weren't large enough as in scale. We needed a broader presence and a broader footprint, and we also needed additional capital to really make this happen, whether it was investment in IT or other things. So we did an evaluation and looked at numbers of partners across the country to see what would fit best. We talked to for-profits, not-for-profits, and we were very fortunate in getting into a discussion with Trinity, which is the second largest not-for-profit health system in the United States, has 90-some hospitals, 21 regions basically across the country, and a lot of other services, one of the largest home care companies in the country, lots of long-term care. And they own two assets in this region. They own Sisters of Providence Health System in Springfield, and they have Mercy Housing here in Hartford, which is a mile away from St. Francis. And these were standalones in this new era of consolidation. I don't know, we call them like orphan hospitals in a sense. They didn't have a support structure to do accountable care. So we joined forces, and Trinity said, well, let's build a platform for a presence in New England on the chassis of St. Francis Care and bring these other pieces together. So we formed a very significant organization that's growing, because we have Sisters of Providence that we merged in October. We brought Johnson Memorial Hospital at the first of the year, and we have a rehab hospital on the Mount Sinai campus. So we have four hospital licenses now, and a fifth coming probably towards the end of this month with St. Mary's in Waterbury joining us.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, great news looming across the horizon in Waterbury.
Yeah, what a great organization. And one of our goals was to really focus on getting like organizations that are really committed to the community. Our whole mission statement is the patient first, the community first, and do everything there to do that best. And we're bringing and also maintaining our Catholic heritage. So pulling these hospitals together, and especially St. Mary's, a wonderful organization in Waterbury that's going to be joining us really makes that happen.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the faith-based aspect, because I'd like you to talk candidly a little bit about that. There was always the element of pastoral care, no matter what the hospital was. But I mean, there is a loyal following that really really hasn't diminished much as the kind of the face of the Catholic Church in America has changed. There's still a unique population that wants that added spiritual component in a place, whether they're going to get some kind of outpatient podiatric procedure or triple bypass.
Right. Well, the underlying premises. I mean, I think we're differentiating ourselves very much from other healthcare systems in Connecticut and nationally because of who we are and what our value system is. We're not here to get a return on investment to our shareholder. We're not here just to build a strong empire with a controlling kind of healthcare enterprise. We're here really focused at taking care of every single person in the community, the most vulnerable. That's where the Catholic identity comes in and its mission, because everyone it needs to be taken care of equally with on the same level, and all the most vulnerable people, there's a special focus on that to make sure that they're taken care of in the same way as everyone that has access to care. So we're trying to create new access points. We're out in the community with tremendous outreach programming. So it's a different organization because it's Catholic and because of our commitment to our values.
Yeah, the other thing I think that's really important to talk about in the time that we have left is that if a person never has the occasion in the communities that Trinity Health New England serves to come into one of the institutions or be cared for or served by it, Trinity Health New England is still making a huge difference to that individual, especially if they're taxpayers, because you pay the state almost $43 million annually in hospital taxes. You contribute a massive amount of direct property taxes in these communities. You're making huge investments in these institutions, bringing up the property and personal property values in these hospitals. And you're creating sustainable healthcare networks that have collateral effect on the quality of life of every single person from birth to the centurions.
Well, thank you. You sound like one of our strongest advocates here. That's wonderful. No, but you explained it very well, because the healthcare industry is a tremendous engine in Connecticut too. It's not just ourselves, but we do so much to support the economy, the infusion of dollars are in the billions of what it means to Connecticut, high-paying jobs, and then the commitment to the underserved is tremendous. And I appreciate your understanding of that, because it really is very, very significant.
Great. In the last couple minutes that we have with you, I wanted to also focus on something else that may be of interest from a regulatory standpoint. All but one of these healthcare institutions is in Connecticut, but then you have the one in Springfield.
Springfield, right.
Well, how is it walking that tightrope between two sometimes vastly different types of state government and regulatory environments?
Well, we're kind of new at it, and we're learning as we go. I think over the course of the near future, things have to change and be melded so that kind of the border disappears. I mean, we're really trying to figure out how we can really work as an integrated system, being on two sides of a border, and whether it's contracting with the different payers and insurance companies or working under the different regulations. I think they have to become more aligned and in common so that we can do business, because that's happening all around. I think Yale has a hospital in Rhode Island that they have to work with. There's going to be more of that. that, not less. And we just have to learn how to do that better. We don't have all the answers yet, but we're working with both sides of the regulatory process in Massachusetts and in Connecticut to make that smoother, and also all the payers.
And I guess the other last and most important point to make is that, you know, the days of the boutique or standalone community or neighborhood hospital appear to be limited, or at least those institutions appear to be limited. And I think it's important for people to realize, when you're talking like an organization like Trinity Health with 3,900 physicians and a massive potential for getting important data and research done, this really serves a global good.
Yes, it really does. And that doesn't mean that we're not committed to those communities where those small hospitals are, because what we're trying to do is find the way to keep healthcare local at the right level, at the right price, you know, and the right locations for access. So that we're not saying we're not committed to the community. We may restructure and redesign what that looks like in those locations, because it's going to be less about keeping hospitals, keeping patients in these huge, big tertiary hospitals. It's really keeping them in the high-quality, low-cost settings, because that's really the trend and where we really need to get to.
Excellent. Chris Dedlas, great to meet you and speak with you, and I know we'll be talking again. Chris is the new president and CEO of Trinity Health New England, a four-hospital system incorporating St. Francis, Mount Sinai, Johnson & Mercy Medical Center in Springfield, and we hope in the next few days we'll be hearing more about exciting news, perhaps bringing St. Mary's Hospital in Waterbury into the fold. Great to speak with you, Chris. Thanks for being part of the program. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.